So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to Review Man.
Michaels pulled referee Earl Hebner right in front of Bret Hart. And I think Hart and the referee hit head.
Is that a disqualification?
It might be if he could get up and call it. And again, Michaels wrecking the face. What did... Look at this!
Oh, you're kidding me.
Michaels, are you going to try to beat Bret Hart with a sharpshooter? Yes, he is! Are you kidding me?
Welcome to Review Away. It is John Pollock and Wei Ting. And Wei, we are in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. We have come all the way here just to review the 1997 Survivor Series.
I'd say it was worth the drive. I think we should be doing these more often. Just go to the destinations of whatever show we're about to talk about.
We are currently in the locker room where Vince McMahon was punched by Bret Hart.
Yep.
Vince's jaw is hanging right there on the ground.
I see the blood. I see the spit that... I see Bret's spit that is falling off of Vince's face. It's still here, 15 years later.
Amazing. Wait, this is obviously... how do you review the 97 Survivor Series? I mean, this is probably the most famous match... this is the most famous wrestling match of our lifetimes. Mm-hmm. And beyond that, I would say of the last, like, 30 years, this is the most famous... pro wrestling match.
We're 28, so 30.
That's not really an exaggeration then. Yeah, we are old. Anyway, people are familiar with what happened at the Survivor Series, 1997.
No, you know what? We say that, but is that honestly true? Because today, we spoke to a UFC fighter, Nick Ring, who was actually accompanied by Bret Hart with his entrance, the last time the UFC was here in Calgary, and a big deal was actually made of that in the local papers. Well, you brought up how you're about to fight in Montreal on this UFC card, the home of the Survivor Series 97 screwjob.
No way!
Nick Ring had absolutely no idea.
His response was, when I told him what happened to Bret Hart, well, if that's true, it's like, what?
Like he didn't believe you. Like this didn't happen.
It's like, if this guy gets walked down to the octagon by Bret Hart, you would think that Nick Ring would know the story.
My point is, I have a feeling that obviously this match is of utmost importance to people like you, me, and anybody who knows
wrestling fans
anything about pro. Well, yeah, but to a John Cena fan, a current John Cena fan, I mean, and to a casual fan from the 80s who really just, you know. They might remember Hogan and Andre. They might remember even Hogan and Warrior. But do they necessarily remember Survivor Series 1997?
I think a giant number of people remember the 97 Survivor
Series. A giant number of people, but we're saying that this is the most...
What wrestling match is more famous than this?
Hogan and Andre?
I don't think so.
Well, it depends who you ask, doesn't it?
I guess so.
What else?
Yeah, that's all.
Is that it?
Yep.
Okay.
Good show. I noticed, Wei, you left the majority of this pay-per-view to just moments before. You just finished watching 2 hours. Somehow you were able to watch this in 1 hour, and I looked over, and it looked like everyone was really had their working boots on. They were working like a lucha style, very quick.
Maybe you were, I don't know.
Do you want to let the listeners in on some of your tactics of how you watch these events so
fast? What are you talking about? What tactics?
I would say the speed on your video. It seemed suspicious.
Well, I do watch these occasionally at 1.5 times the speed. Oh, sacrilege.
Oh, Jesus.
My journalistic integrity right out the window. Yeah. Yeah, that's really it.
Well, I have very little to add in terms of going into this event. We did review Raw last week, the go-home show for this. And, Wei, I assume you had never watched this pay-per-view before, or had you?
No, I hadn't. I mean, the main event, I'm pretty sure everybody's seen it, but the rest of the show, no, absolutely not.
Well, there was actually, contrary to popular belief, there was an undercard to Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. There were matches on this card mm-hmm. before the main event.
Yep.
And that's what we're going to take you through, everybody. Sunday, November the 9th, 1997, from the Molson Center, now the Bell Center.
Yes.
All these years later, it's still the same building, just a different name.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are just literally like a minute away from the Bell Center right now, from our hotel room.
Yeah, so we exchanged a beer company for a telecommunications company. That might someday own the beer company. Who knows? Bell owns almost everything these days.
Maybe one day it'll be the Bell Rogers Center when Bell and Rogers merge to create the Megazord of Canadian telecommunications.
And then no doubt some American major company will buy it. And it'll be, every building will basically become the Disney Center. The GE Disney.
George Lucas.
Viacom Center.
Film Center.
Yeah.
Well, Survivor Series kicked off with a video. This was kind of just highlights of that great video we talked about from Raw last week, building up this match.
Mm-hmm.
And going into this event, Wei, there was tons of buzz. Tons of buzz.
Well, let's set the scene again. What exactly happened between the end of that Raw reviewed last week and Survivor Series this Sunday?
This was that week going into the show was where everything really took a drastic turn. It was actually, because the Raw would have been November the 3rd. By November the 3rd, Bret had actually signed with WCW. So it actually, the deal had taken place by the time Raw did air, and Bret was not on that show. Because he had a deal where at the end of October 31st, once that day concluded, his contract would have rolled over for like another year. So they had to figure it out. And it was a late deal put together, and he ended up signing with WCW with the idea that they were going to keep all of this quiet and he would work possibly till as far as the December pay-per-view. Mm-hmm. And going into the show, as has been very well documented, it was basically they had worked out this finish for a DQ. And then Bret would hopefully hand the title over to Vince the next night in Ottawa, give a speech, disappear, and everyone would go on their merry way.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what happened.
Nope.
No, it is not. So that's kind of where the setting here was. But this did leak during the week. The hotlines and newsletters got word of this. It became a big, big talking point everywhere. Everyone was going nuts about Bret leaving. They did some house shows, including one at the Sky Dome and then Detroit the two nights prior before the Survivor Series. And the result was, with all this speculation, with all the build-up for this match, the real-life animosity they had put together with Bret and Shawn, this was a pay-per-view that just everyone felt was important. Like, there was just a ton of interest for this pay-per-view and this match because no one was sure of how this was going to end.
Yeah, and I think it's especially interesting that it took place in a city really, I guess, known for a very smart and aware audience. You know, if this had taken place in, I don't know, Poughkeepsie, wherever Poughkeepsie is, I don't know if it would have necessarily had as much heat.
So you know how Vince McMahon got ready for the biggest news event in, well, one of the biggest news stories ever. You know what he did the night before, Wei?
What did he do?
He went out for dinner.
Where?
Well, he had a big meeting. Apparently, this is how it went down, was that Vince had a meeting with Shawn Michaels, with Jim Ross, I believe Jim Cornette, who was on the creative team, was involved, Bruce Prichard. And allegedly, after this meeting, they went out for dinner to Schwartz Deli.
Really? Vince? Jim Cornette?
I don't know who went with Vince, but oh. he was with at least Jim Ross and Bruce Prichard, and they went out for smoked meat at Schwartz.
Well, the world famous Schwartz Deli.
Where we had dinner tonight.
Yes, we did.
Just to get ready for this review.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of this, Wei Ting is going to cut me out as host of this, as co-host.
Yes. I'm going to call...
The podcast screw job.
I'm going to call for the finish of this podcast abruptly.
Hit the music!
Yeah.
As a siren goes off outside.
Yes, we did go to Schwartz Deli because we wanted to fully immerse ourselves into the mindset.
What was Vince McMahon thinking?
Yeah, how?
Maybe he had the salami and he was just so upset.
Because you had both. You had the salami and...
I ate two sandwiches at this place and you thought I was an animal.
Hey, no, you were,
Your actual words are, go for it. Do it.
Yes.
The smoked meat was one of the best sandwiches I've ever had in my life.
Mm-hmm.
It was great.
It was a salami.
It was not one of the best sandwiches I've had in my life.
It actually looks like turkey more than salami.
It looks identical to turkey. We had a guy next to us who was...
You sure they didn't give you turkey by accident?
It doesn't matter. It was terrible.
Okay.
It tasted like salami. There's a difference between salami and turkey. You can just taste it.
Okay.
And... I ordered the second one. It was cold. It was plain.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like it.
Well,
but the smoked meat. How was the smoked meat?
Well, it was fantastic. It was really good. Recommended highly.
It was great.
So we wanted to know, hey, what was Vince McMahon's stomach feeling like the night before Survivor Series?
What do you think he ordered that night?
I would assume...
I've heard that their black cherry cola is their specialty
drink. Is that right?
Yes.
I saw it. It just looks like cold cola.
Don't want that.
Cold black cherry cola. I mean, I'm willing to try it, absolutely. We've also been told on Twitter that the place across the street was even better.
Maybe.
Mains.
Maybe that's a metaphor for WWF and WCW.
Hmm.
And Brett... was sick of the smoked meat, and he wanted to cross the street for $3.5 million a year.
This is what you're going to get from this podcast. I mean,
but he was holding the pickle, and he wouldn't drop the pickle.
Oh God, stop it, please. This is no, there's Wrestling with Shadows. There's Dave Meltzer's very extensive write-up of the entire event of Survivor Series.
Dave Meltzer's observers on this topic are the utmost authority on what happened during this time. Because he spoke to everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. There's that fantastic Brett and Sean DVD that the WWE put out. And let's give a shout-out to something that you and I worked on, that Bret Hart documentary with George Barbosa for the Fight Network that you can find a bootleg copy of all over YouTube.
It's what I like to call the forgot-umentary, because everyone's forgot about it. It's just kind of drifted.
Well, we didn't exactly publicize it too much, nor did we make it really available outside of that two-week window that it aired on our channel.
Yeah. Wasn't it on YouTube?
Yes, it was. And it still is, actually. People have been...
Survival of the Hitman.
Survival of the Hitman.
Which I do say so, as I do say, I'm biased. I think it's a pretty well-done documentary myself.
Much of my knowledge about, a lot of the events from Brett's own perspective came from filming that documentary. Just to think back on the day when we shot that at his house, playing the scene for him of the finish to Survivor Series 97 as Brett is watching on my laptop and commenting, it's a scene that I guess personally I won't forget, but it's a scene that I think was very beneficial, I guess, to everybody's knowledge of the events that took place on this show.
Yeah, we basically spent 5 hours with Brett talking about his entire life, and a lot of it was on the Survivor Series, to the point that as we are just talking about, like, 97, our freelancer, not Way, our freelance cameraman tells me we have one tape left.
Yeah.
And I'm in my head freaking during this interview as he whispers this to me, knowing that we are at 97 right now of his career.
I don't even think we were at 97. I think we were at, like, 93.
Oh.
Something like that.
I don't understand how this guy...
Hey, in defense of cameramen, five tapes, approximately, these are like small beta tapes, so approximately two and a half hours. He didn't know Bret Hart, okay? He didn't know how long-winded of a person any of the Hart family members are. When you're talking to a Hart family member, you better be prepared. You better bring the EP tapes.
Anyway, we got through it. Very captivating, though, this one day that Bret Hart... It's 5 hours of, like, if you're a Bret Hart fan,
yeah,
this covers everything.
Yeah. Just to go back to that day, I just remember it was so bizarre because here I was in Bret Hart's house, and a child, I guess a teenage...
Yeah, teenage.
Teenage boy is
Blade.
In the front yard, introduces himself. Hey, I'm Blade. And they're about to go see Avatar that day with Bret. Those are my memories that I like to share with the world.
Avatar.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we do have a bit of a unique perspective to this, spending all that time working on that documentary, which, was an insane turnaround for us, where from concept to airing, it was the day after Bret returned on Raw that I came up with the idea of just doing, like, a feature piece for the network just on Bret returning, and maybe we could interview someone in town.
Mm-hmm.
And it just grew. And that thing debuted, like, March the 24th or something. So we're talking, like, from January 5th to March 24th.
Yeah.
That was our turnaround.
Yeah, and it was you, George Barbosa,
Steve Duncan.
Steve Duncan. Everybody.
And you. And that was it. It was, like, four people.
Yep, just spending a lot of extra hours over the weekend. But you know what? I mean, I was so happy when that eventually came out. Like, you know, it's one of the more prouder things that I've done in my career to be involved with that. So that's like work you want to put in.
So now we head into the actual event itself. And we mentioned the video off the top. The announcers tonight way, Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler. No Vince McMahon.
Mm-hmm.
So this was very noteworthy at the time and was kind of done as they had basically pushed on Jim Ross's hotline the fact that we have hired armed security to keep Bret and Shawn apart before the match. Like, just being very... adding a lot of hyperbole. That was not true at all. But also taking Vince McMahon off the announce desk to kind of emphasize how important this was and really acknowledging, well, Vince McMahon is not just the announcer. He is actually the guy that runs this company, which I don't think was ever explicitly said before. It was obviously in 97 teased very heavily, but I don't know if it was outright said. And this was kind of a real public announcement that, you know, Vince McMahon is in the back to take care of everything because...
Well, there's that one scene where, this entire time, Sergeant Slaughter was the figurehead of the company. And he was there to be interviewed and alongside Vince McMahon, who the world had known only as a commentator. Why is he all of a sudden standing there with the commentator? But this commentator actually spoke at more length than Sergeant Slaughter and seemed to be have more control than Sergeant Slaughter. So this really was an admission. Without really having to say so, that, hey, this is the real boss behind the scenes.
We also had the Spanish announce team, Carlos Cabrero and Tito Santana.
Karate fighters.
Yes, we had karate fighters. And we also had a French announce team, Jacques Rougeau Sr., Raymond Rougeau, and Jean Brassard.
Wow. Okay.
Just for the French-speaking audience.
I think that's important.
Yeah. When have we ever seen a French announce team? Very rare. There was a handful of pay-per-views they had French announce teams.
Hmm.
And then our ring announcer, Albert de Frusia. They keyed him.
Yeah.
This was strange. They chose to have a French in-ring announcer for, like, the pay-per-view crowd. They must have been so confused.
I think that's cool.
Everything was so weird about this show.
Yes. And imagine how weird for somebody like myself who stopped watching between the gap of March of 96 to this point where the landscape had completely changed. And you can really see that in the differences between that Bret and Shawn match and this Bret and Shawn match. Just the total landscape of how wrestling was presented was so different.
You left wrestling after Bret lost to Shawn. Were you aware this match was happening, this big rematch that might pull you back in?
No, I wasn't.
Oh.
Until years later.
And as Wei mentioned, we had a Karate Fighters blimp inside of the Molson Center.
Mm-hmm.
The sold-out Molson Center, so that was great for the crowd, the deal with a blimp. And then we go to our first matchup of the night. It was a traditional Survivor Series match, and they show an episode of Raw where Billy Gunn used a boombox to the head of Thrasher, busting him open on Raw from 3 weeks ago. And then Road Dogg comes out with him and does his promo, and he points to the Headbangers and the New Blackjacks already in the ring as the Steers and Queers.
Yes.
And then calls Canadians real-life Yankee bastards.
No. Well, this was the Attitude Era. People say shit in their promos now.
So we've got the Headbangers and the New Blackjacks against Billy Gunn, Jesse James, and the Godwins.
The Black Drax and the Buttbangers, as he also calls them.
The what?
The Buttbangers.
The Buttbangers.
Yeah. What heels?
Wow. Barry Windham. A very rotund Barry Windham here. I was not even trying to make a Mike Rotunda joke there, as I realized I did.
Okay.
So Windham here has an abdominal stretch and gets rolled up, Henry Godwin to pin him at 3 minutes and 4.
It was Phineas, I think, wasn't it?
I think it was Henry. Who cares? Windham then hits a big lariat to Phineas. I was
pig.
And then eliminates Bradshaw. These are all quick eliminations.
Yeah. As was...
I hate Survivor Series matches. I'll just say it outright. I know a lot of people are nostalgic for them. I thought the majority of Survivor Series matches have sucked. Like, 90% of them are bad, and this was a bad one.
The finishes are very hard to buy because...
They're just out of nowhere. They're quick.
They take place way too quickly without much justification.
Billy Gunn gets tagged in.
You know what they should do? They should, like... To allow for quick finish... quick pinfalls early in the match, they should they should just say we fed the entire locker room with I don't know,
hallucinogenics.
Yeah, with crystal meth.
La fin du monde. They all drank cases of La fin du monde.
La fin du monde, just like what we're drinking right now. This 9% Quebec beer, triple fermented.
How many have you had?
This is only my second. I think it's delicious. You're not a big fan, John.
It's too bitter for me.
La fin du monde. You
I like beer. Light beer. That's it.
Okay. Well, yes.
You're the hard drinker.
I'm really crazy. I'm a regular...
Bradshaw.
Bradshaw, exactly. That's what they should have said. Because of the language barrier here, and because of the high geography... of this town, everybody's been thrown into a daze. That's why they're able to get pinned so much quicker than usual.
Sure, why not?
Some explanation.
Well, Billy Gunn got tagged in, Wei, and, you know, we talked last week about an isolated incident where he received a chant. This chant followed him to Montreal.
Yeah. Yes, it did. Where was last week's show?
Hershey Park, Pennsylvania.
Okay, well...
this is a different country. Montreal. And... saying it in English, no less.
Yeah. A major faggot chant erupts in Montreal as Billy Gunn takes the ring. And this was really, I guess, a part of his character that they were embracing. Because you can't really say that they weren't encouraging this. Because here the announcers pick up on it, and Lawler almost kind of makes fun of it, saying, "What are these people saying?
What if they had gone the
is it in French?"
Lawler did say that. What if they had gone the direction instead of calling him Mr. Ass? What if they had called him this, Mr.
Fag?
What if they had called him that? Do you think that would have?
Yeah. No, I don't know. I don't know if they could have ran with that. I don't even think you could say that on TV.
I guess they could. They had these chants.
Anyway, this was only 15 years ago, and Montreal, no less, a city that I consider to be quite liberal. So I guess a wrestling crowd. You know what? I don't know. 15 years ago, it's kind of unfortunate.
At least no one had a heart attack during this match.
Right
in Montreal, in the arena. mm-hmm. where Jerry Lawler had his heart attack.
And who knows what'll happen 15 years later in that arena.
What an arena in terms of WWF history.
True.
Billy Gunn eliminated Mosh next, just dropped him face first. Then Thrasher and Bradshaw are left on the babyface team. Thrasher hits a top rope seated senton to pin Phineas at 12:25. Bradshaw comes in, kills Road Dogg, hits a gut-wrench powerbomb, attacks Billy Gunn on the apron, and then Road Dogg with a roll-up at 13:30. But they didn't ring the bell here, so we didn't even know if Bradshaw was eliminated or not. He was. It's down to the New Age Outlaws against Thrasher. Thrasher was the babyface hope here. And Road Dogg hits an abdominal stretch, gets flipped over. Blind tag as Billy Gunn hits a top rope leg drop that completely misses Thrasher. And Road Dogg gets put on top, pins Thrasher, 15:09. This match sucked, and Billy Gunn and Jesse James were the survivors.
Road Dogg, a badass Billy Gunn, as the announcer put it.
A.E.T.
Not a good match at all. Just a bunch of heavyweight brawling.
97 is remembered as a great year of storylines, but the roster was pretty terrible in 97. Let's be honest here. And I'm not saying that on personalities. That was what they were thriving on. But in-ring, really rough.
Yes.
And this pay-per-view really exposed that. Which leads us to our next match. Recon, Sniper, The Interrogator, and Jackal. Three of the four that I think Way would have, well, two of the four, I think any wrestling fan would have a hard time ever identifying out of a lineup, taking on the foursome of Crush, Chains, Skull, and 8-Ball, the Aces and Eights.
Yeah, the Aces and Eights of yesteryear.
Do you want to explain who the Interrogator is?
Was he Kurgan?
Yes.
Is that Kurgan?
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, Kurgan as well as Recon. Recon is Bull Buchanan, right?
I didn't even put two and two together there. It was. Well, and Sniper was just who was Sniper?
I have no idea.
I didn't look him up.
Yeah, taking on the DOA, the Disciples of Apocalypse, who are huge baby faces here in Montreal. Heavy gang, biker gang contingent represented here in Montreal.
Well, remember when we reviewed No Way Out 2003 and Undertaker wore a shirt that read TCB, Taking Care of Business, and some reader from Montreal sent us in feedback talking about how it was like this gang that was like...
TCB, like a Hell's Angels thing?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay. Why not? Speaking of The Undertaker, another enlightening sign here in the audience. The Undertaker is not a homo. Just in big block letters. I don't know what...
When you said The Undertaker, I thought you were going to make a Chains reference here. Brian Lee, The Underfaker.
Right, okay. No, I did not say that. But I don't know what the significance of this message was. I don't know. Was there like a gay angle with The Undertaker at this time?
Well, maybe that's Kane. Where they thought the Kane thing was going. It was an estranged lover.
This sign, just all of a sudden, Undertaker is not a homo. And this is
Kane comes back telling The Undertaker the flame still burns. I guess people can interpret it as romantic angle.
He would be like the big rainbow-colored machine then.
Could have been. You don't know what original plans were.
Anyway, this was the Attitude Era for you.
The Undertaker was injured here. Wasn't even on this show.
No, he was not.
But we got Skull.
I wonder if these signs and these chants are in WWE 13.
Yeah, maybe. The Jackal here was Don Callis, who was the fourth member, but barely part of this match. Basically, the Truth Commission. I bet you most people forget this group, and that's putting it mildly. It was all based around the Interrogator, Kurgan, and trying to push this guy, this big guy.
Okay. What does that mean? He's the interrogator.
No, he interrogates you. When shit needs to be pried out of victims.
Yeah, but he's a wrestler.
He doubles as an interrogator.
I didn't see him doing much talk.
There's a sniper here. A guy who acknowledges I kill people. Sniper.
Where was his rifle? Where's his
Let's find out who Sniper was. I am now curious.
This guy's a sniper. Well, I don't trust a man like that. I mean, I'm sure from a distance he's very effective, but this is professional wrestling. I didn't see him doing any sniper-related activities.
Luke Poirier.
Okay, there we go. Mystery solved. The Truth Commission, the legendary...
He would later perform under such monikers as Rocky Montana and Rambo.
Wow.
Copyright infringement gimmick. No. Yeah. That would be, maybe he would be under an interrogation. Okay, this match does have to begin eventually. Recon comes in, does a bunch of moves. Oh, sorry, first they pinned... Who did they pin here? The interrogator dives into a corner turnbuckle with a headbutt and hits a sidewalk slam to pin Chains. Then Recon tags in, but Jackal wants a tag, hits a top rope knee that Skull no-sells, attacks the Jackal, hitting a side slam and eliminates the Jackal at 252, which put Jackal on commentary, where I thought he was very good.
Yeah.
He was a good talker. That was the biggest benefit for him.
He was that was his role in the group, was it not? Just the fact that this guy can talk. Don Callis.
Yeah. The one of Lance Storm's longtime contemporaries. Mm-hmm. So, Jackal's on commentary. Skull and 8-Ball do the twin switch here, twin magic. And one of them gets bumped to the floor. They clothesline Recon, eliminate him. Then the Skull and 8-Ball, later the Harris brothers, later they had previously been the Blue Brothers. They were also Creative Control in WCW. Mm-hmm. Every stupid name that they had. They hit the H-Bomb here. And to Sniper, who kicks out when the interrogator distracts the ref. We see a really shitty bulldog by the Sniper to eliminate Skull. Then a blind tag by the interrogator.
It doesn't matter.
Okay.
Just go to the finish.
Crush hit with a tilt-a-whirl slam pins Sniper, and then the interrogator hits a sidewalk slam. I think there have been 85 sidewalk slams that I've described in this match. 10 minutes this went. This still sucked, and... After the interrogator pinned Crush, Jackal proclaimed that he won the Survivor Series. Okay.
It just doesn't matter because one guy might as well be the other. They're all... The problem with this... By the way, this pay-per-view, a little-known fact, was subtitled Gang Rules.
Yeah,
Gang
with
Rules.
A Z.
With a Z, yes. Spray-painted on a Photoshop.
These were two gangs.
These were two gangs.
The one gang of bikers and the others with berets and marching.
This was the faction wars, I guess, at its height. And it was just a complete oversaturation of something that probably stemmed from the success of the NWO.
One group that got over, and then the WWF copied them with a million of them, and none of them got over.
And the problem, to me, is because you couldn't even tell one person from the others. They just simply seemed to think, let's dress everybody in the same clothes and, you know, make them a pack, and hey, there you go. But I guess...
Even Jim Ross admitted, I can't tell these two apart with 8-Ball and Skull.
Yeah, like, the thing is, like, you look at the most successful factions in wrestling history. You think of the Horsemen, you think of even, you know, DX, you might even think of the Nation. And at the very least, you could tell each individual member apart. Everybody had their own personalities. Here, these guys might as well have been two different putty patrols.
So you weren't a fan of the Truth Commission or DOA?
You know, I quite enjoy talking about them right now, but I didn't enjoy watching them, no.
They then interviewed some fans, including a French version of Paul Bearer, about who was going to win the main event. These fans were stoked for this main event.
I like these.
They're great.
I wish they would do more of these, just talking to fans, excited fans.
French-Canadian wrestling fans are the best.
Sure.
Bret Hart! Then Jim Ross talks about eating smoked meat at Schwartz. The night before.
I guess Jim Ross might have been there.
He must have been there, obviously. Yeah. I think a lot of people were there that night.
Talking business.
At Schwartz.
Yeah.
You know what, guys? Let's change the finish tomorrow night. But Vince, we've agreed on it already. We booked the next month. Fuck it.
Fuck it. The sandwich, I mean, life's too short. Let's just do what I want to do.
God damn it.
Let's smoke him like the smoked meat.
Kevin Kelly is in the AOL chat room with Steve Austin and...
Keyword, superstars.
This, how the fuck were you able to find this? You know what you had to do? You had to log on to AOL, click on international, then click on sports, and use the keyword superstars.
It was ridiculous. It sounded ridiculous.
How did the internet work in 1997? Because I didn't have it.
Me neither. I think I did towards the end, but AOL is only like one... Definitely the most publicized way to get on the net at that point. But I think in school, you simply... Like, Netscape was around. Yahoo was around.
Netscape.
Yeah. And that was, like... That was a major search engine, right?
Yeah.
Yahoo. Wasn't there one before that?
Yahoo was, like, the big one. Yeah.
Well, You speak of Yahoo like it's, you know, like it's something that nobody thinks of anymore.
No one quick, Yahoo this. When have you ever heard someone say that? Yahoo this. Let's go Yahoo Sniper of the Truth Commission.
I still use Yahoo Mail.
You do?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yahoo Mail.
I still have a Hotmail account.
Yes, you do.
Yeah, I do.
Yes, you do.
What's wrong with Hotmail?
Nothing. Nothing is wrong with Hotmail. It's just absolutely terrible.
You still like Yahoo?
I use its email. I'm pretty much stuck with it. I've had it for, like, years. Anyway, what am I saying? We're talking about Netscape. And we somehow got into Yahoo. AOL. I never used AOL, but I'm assuming...
Are chat these... rooms... Do they still have chat rooms on Yahoo? Do most
play... I don't know. I'd assume so. Why would they abandon that?
Those are so fun. The first time I ever used the internet was at my friend Sean's apartment. And he showed me just the internet. And on Yahoo, it's like, yeah, you can go into a chat. I'm like, you can talk to people on the internet? I thought this was the coolest thing in the world. And I would go to his house just to use chat. And I'd just talk to random people.
What were your rooms?
I went into wrestling chat rooms.
Okay.
And I would try and find out shit.
So what did you talk to these people about? What would you ask
them? Okay, well, I remember in particular, the King of the Ring was coming up. And one of the guys in a chat room was telling me, because the slogan for that year's King of the Ring, I'll always remember this, was off with their heads, because they had a guillotine on it. And they were like, they're putting the belt on Al Snow at the King of the Ring. And I was like, how do you know this? They're like, that's the reason they're using off with their heads as the slogan. I was like, whoa, of course, of course. Why? I felt so stupid for not knowing that. And
so began your journalism career.
Yeah. I got trolled at the age of 14.
Yes.
I thought chat rooms were the fucking coolest.
Well, they were. And in many ways, they're still around, you know, in the form of...
You only hear about chat rooms now in cases of, like, where a crime is about to be committed, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah. I'm surprised as a young boy you became, I don't know, quite unscathed.
That we didn't get a... Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Boy, did you just take this podcast to a wall, a brick wall, a firewall.
It's the La Fin du Monde.
Anyway, Kevin Kelly was at the AOL chat room with Steve Austin. They were asking him about the status of his neck. Basically, all the questions George St. Pierre is getting this week about his knee is what Austin was getting about his neck. Be his first match back tonight after his neck injury from the SummerSlam event. Then Ross and Lawler discuss Milton Bradley's Karate Fighters being a big reason for the success of the Survivor Series, to the point that the WWF held a party with Milton Bradley Karate Fighters the night before, and we got footage of this with the Headbangers in a dimly lit room, looking bored, having to play with a kid who I guess was Milton Bradley's son. I don't know what was going on here, but my God, did WWF love Milton Bradley's Karate Fighters in the fall of 97.
You pay these people any money, I'm sure you'd love them. Yeah.
They show an angle from Raw from the Monday previous where Steve Blackman ran as a fan, and Jerry Lawler notes that he's a martial arts expert and he knows jiu-jitsu.
Wow.
And he's on Vader's team now because Vader bailed him out of jail to get him on his Survivor Series team. So Vader believed in this guy.
What TV was there between Raw and Sunday and Survivor Series?
Well, your Saturday Superstars, but that wasn't a show anyone watched.
So somehow, between these 6 days, they had established this guy's name, some type of backstory that bailed him out, and then put him in a starring role on this team?
Absolutely.
Okay, sure.
Just think of that, back in this time where you'd watch Raw, and that would be your only TV till the pay-per-view.
2 hours.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a concept. Could you imagine how much better it would be if we only had to watch 2 hours of WWE a week?
Yeah, well, all this stuff matches demand, right? And, you know, when it did expand to SmackDown, I'm sure there was a lot of demand for that. But at this point, that demand is quickly shrinking, and they're still expanding.
Michael Cole is with Team USA in the back, And Michael Cole asked him what the common thread is amongst them, and Vader just had a blank stare for like the two longest seconds ever.
Let's name the members of this team.
We had Vader, Goldust, Steve the Fan Blackman, and
Mark Maron.
What a motley crew.
Nothing says America like Vader, Goldust, and
Steve Blackman. Blackman.
Yeah.
So we had these four, two heels, two baby faces, against Team Canada, consisting of the British Bulldog, the American Jim Neidhart, the American Doug Furness, and Canadian Phil LaFon. There were actually two Canadians in this match. Do you know who the second one was?
Who?
Jimmy Corderas.
Ah.
The referee. Team Canada got a massive reaction as they came out with Canadian and Quebecois flags.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Oh, you forgot to mention that the Kurt Angle theme walked out the American team.
That's true. Yep. They did. The Patriots theme.
The Patriots
at this theme. Time. Jim Ross brings up how LaFon is the only Canadian here, and Lawler says, "Shut up, JR. Don't let details get in the way of a good story." Yeah. Bulldog here had a knee brace on his right knee, which he would actually hyperextend, breaking up a fight later on in the evening.
Oh.
Yes. Vader comes off a turnbuckle into a slam by the Bulldog, and then Bulldog hits a vertical suplex to Vader.
Mm-hmm.
Very impressive. Blackman gets tagged in, hits the brogue kick to Phil LaFon, who looked slower than usual here. This was after LaFon and Furness were involved in a big car accident earlier that year, and that was the impetus for their heel turn, when they didn't get well wishes from the Americans. Every country but the U.S. Sable chant began here as Blackman was kicking out of a bunch of pin attempts, and then they attacked the other members of Team Canada. They fight on the floor here, and Blackman gets counted out as the referee begins explaining the rules to Steve Blackman. He didn't understand, unfortunately.
Well, he's a black belt. He's not a pro wrestler.
Countouts. Crowd got big into Neidhart's offense here. He shoulder tackled Vader, but then he runs chest first and gets splashed by Vader, and Neidhart is eliminated. Then we saw Vader come in belly to belly and a splash off the second rope. He eliminates Phil LaFon. Then Furness kicks out of a roll up, stacks Mark Maron to eliminate Maron. Furness then gets a low blow to Vader. Ref is distracted. Goldust is just kind of sitting on the apron, not doing much. And when Vader goes for a tag, Goldust simply just leaves. And Jim Ross chastises him because he's walking out on everybody. His wife, his child, and now Vader.
Mm.
He's walking out on everybody.
This was following, of course, last week's excellent segment with Jim Ross and out of character Dustin Reynolds and Terry.
Vader then delivers splashes to Furness and Bulldog as he's left on his own. Bulldog gets the ring bell as Vader then hits the ring bell onto Furness for a pin at 17:35, and then Vader turns around, gets hit with the bell, and Bulldog pins Vader 17 minutes and 48 seconds. British Bulldog, the lone survivor. This was certainly the best match of the three thus far on the show. I thought Bulldog looked really good in this match.
This was really, yes, the high points of the match were really when Bulldog was in the ring, but other than that, not very notable. I guess it was worth watching just to see them strike that balance by, you know, taking a heel team, and in this case the Canadian team, and making them still be cheered while still employing heel tactics like cheating. So that was interesting. This crowd was very much into Bulldog, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. Then we got a video on Kane and The Undertaker and their past, and Kane being revealed the prior month at Hell in a Cell. And Undertaker refuses to ever fight his brother. And the storyline is that Kane will destroy everyone until he reaches The Undertaker.
Just think about how simple this Kane character's backstory was at this time. Just, 2 months into his career? At this point, all he was The Undertaker's long-lost burnt brother.
Burnt brother.
Yeah, no, nothing else. And now you could fill a book, in which they did fill a book with his backstory.
Many turns. And look at this. They debuted him in October and didn't do that match with Taker till WrestleMania.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
So anyway, his setup match is against Mick Foley, where he had chokeslammed Dude Love on a steel ramp, and this led to Mankind cutting a promo in retaliation. And Mankind is shown in the back, asked if he has any last words, and he says this will not be a wrestling match. It's Mankind versus a brick wall, and he's going to run through that brick wall over and over again tonight, and he's willing to die trying, and he's upset at Paul Bearer calling him a pebble.
Yes. I thought this was a very good promo from Foley, and it's been so long since you get to see a Mick Foley Mankind promo in this deranged form, because, I mean, as much as my memories of Mankind really are just of a comedic character, you know, of Mick Foley as a comedic character, but he was also so good at this, just basically this crazy freak.
And I had always thought this was Dude Love against Kane on the show, but it was Mankind taking on Kane, and Mankind attacks him on the entranceway, and we got the red dimmed lights, which didn't last very long for Kane.
No, it's just like, is this part of the Kane character's powers that he can put red gels on all these lights in the building?
Terrible color too, like it's just.
Oh, it's supposed to be red.
I know it's supposed to be red. Red's terrible to watch. It's just.
Yeah.
I hated this.
Would you have preferred green?
Light blue.
Like Sin Cara.
Yeah. No, that's just as bad. Anyway. Kane shoves Mankind into the steps with the back of his head crashing into the steps. Kane then sets the pyro off in the ring as the bell rings to start the match, tosses the ring steps at Mankind on the floor, and Kane just beats him down, very one-sided for the first half here. Mankind takes an Irish whip into the steps, knees first. These are the bumps that you watch how hard it is for Mick to get around now, and then you watch stuff like this, and it to me it kind of affects my enjoyment of these matches. But then he lifts Kane, drops him face first on the steps for the first offensive move of the match, and then attacks Kane with a chair, hits a pile driver, uses the mandible claw on Paul Bearer. But then Kane sends Mankind off the apron and through the Spanish announce table, where it looked like Tito Santana got killed here.
Mm-hmm.
And they called attention to Santana being hurt. Mankind blocked the chokeslam, hit a DDT on the floor, then hits an elbow off the apron to Kane. But then Kane gets on the apron, tosses Mankind off the turnbuckle to the floor, and then hits a tombstone to pin Mankind at 9:33. A decent match here, and the Kane character was very over at this point.
Yes, because it was very well protected. They made it a big deal when Mankind was even able to hurt the guy. So, a very good job doing that. And you mentioned how, you know, it's a bit difficult to watch these Foley bumps, knowing how kind of difficult it is for him to walk around these days. And I do agree, but that's part of the draw for me to want to watch one of these matches, is to see Mick Foley back when he was able to take these bumps and do all these things. And you can argue, like, would he have been as popular as he is today without doing any of this? Same with the Hardys.
If you were one of the 3,000 people away to send in your cable bill, you could get a WWF dog tag.
Great.
Michael Cole is with Vince McMahon and Sergeant Slaughter in the back, saying that there's extra security for the main event, hopeful that the match will happen tonight without problems. And then Michael Cole asks Vince, who's going to win? And Vince says, I don't know.
A shoot question.
Whoa, who's going to win? Imagine if he said, Sean.
Yeah.
What an irresponsible question for journalist Michael Cole to ask.
Yeah. It's just so interesting watching this, because even today they would never be this wink-wink about, you know, breaking kayfabe. And I suppose back then it was just such a novelty for them to do it that they would try to inject it at any moment.
Doc Hendricks is with the team of Ken Shamrock, Ahmed Johnson, and the Legion of Doom. Shamrock cuts a generic promo, tells them to knuckle up, and Hawk calls the nation the Sergeant of Arms, Devon.
Right, yes.
And they don't let Ahmed speak.
No.
It's too bad.
That's smart.
I missed the Ahmed promo. And that took us to our next elimination match. It was the Nation of Domination.
No. Le Nation de Domination.
Of course.
As the announcer.
As they were intended to be pronounced. Farouk, LaRock, Kama Mustafa, D'Lo Brown, taking on Ahmed Johnson, Ken Shamrock, and LOD. Ross notes that many insiders feel Ken Shamrock will be the dominant force for years to come.
Mm-hmm.
Those insiders were wrong. But does get a big pop here, as he was being pushed very hard here in late 97. I gave out the Scott Putski Award to Ahmed Johnson on this show, who came out insane and was like wrapped up like a mummy. He had all this padding and everything. He was just, he looked like I don't know what.
Yeah. Yeah. Well deserved. I don't really have any other candidates. So yeah, congratulations.
Ahmed Johnson. He won something. Hawk no sells a pile driver by D'Lo Brown right away. Rock comes in. Brown hits Hawk from behind, and then Rock hits a rock bottom to pin Hawk at 2:15. Short night for Michael Hegstrand.
Mm-hmm.
Then they get Johnson in the heel corner, whip him with a strap. Fruit goes for a slam, but Johnson lands on his feet, loses his balance, but then hits the Pearl River Plunge to eliminate Farouk very early on. Rocky Maivia's in with Johnson, and Farouk holds Johnson's legs down. So Rocky Maivia eliminates Ahmed at 6:25, and then Ahmed and Farouk fight to the back. Very slow here as Animal and Kama then work together. And then some weird siren goes off, and then the announcers sounded like they were in some echo chamber for a few seconds. Did you catch any of this?
This was strange. Yeah. It was a strange show. Maybe it was the signal.
Lawler blamed Kevin Dunn for the sound going off.
Yes.
Next, Animal knocked Kama into Rocky and rolled up Kama to eliminate him. Then Billy Gunn and the Road Dog come out dressed as the Road Warriors with face paint, with the shoulder pads, and Animal attacks and tosses Jack Doan as Road Dog throws powder into Animal's eyes, and Animal avoids doing a job and gets counted out in the entranceway.
Yes.
Blinded.
And then this broke off into another feud. Yeah, it's just fine.
Lawler then says how this is wrestling. You don't win by making people tap out. And Ross contradicts him as Shamrock clotheslines Rocky to the floor, hits a belly-to-belly, applies the ankle lock to D'Lo to eliminate him, and then Rocky comes from behind, slams a chair into the back of Ken Shamrock, who kicks out of that, hits a spinning DDT, gets another two count, people's elbow for a two count, but then Shamrock makes his comeback, Northern Lights suplex, Hurricane Rana, then goes for an armbar into the ankle lock and beats Rocky Maivia. At 20 minutes and 34 seconds, Ken Shamrock is the sole survivor.
So in 3 weeks, this guy Ken Shamrock had looked good against Brett, looked good against Sean, and here got a pinfall over The Rock.
And we'll get the next title shot at the In Your House event.
And you know what? I wouldn't say he was a bad choice to go to push either. I thought he his wrestling looked good. Good enough, at least. The chain wrestling was good, and he had a lot of energy in the ring, so I didn't think he was that bad of a choice.
But it's hilarious when you fast-forward a year to the next Survivor Series, where Rock would win the title on that show, and Ken Shamrock would just be a random member of the corporation.
Well, what do you think went wrong with the push?
With Ken, he wasn't a good promo, and, I mean, his work was never really something that stood out. Just didn't connect with people to that level.
Why do you think he's
and Rock
not,
did?
Why do you think he's not back in pro wrestling?
He's very old, and I don't know if anyone would want him, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a role for him somewhere as a manager of some type of shoot character. You know, like this guy Ken Shamrock. Isn't he taking phone calls
for $11.99?
Yeah, he's basically doing phone sex right now. He's so starved for cash.
Well.
You're telling me there's no job for him in professional wrestling?
I mean, you got to remember, Wei, he was around for 2 years.
Yeah, but he's still...
You're talking about people forgetting the Survivor Series. Believe me, they have long since forgotten about Ken Shamrock.
Yeah, but Ken Shamrock has a real identity with mixed martial arts. There are people that...
Even in MMA, Wei, he hasn't been around since, like, 2006 in the UFC.
Yes, but he's still a legendary name. You mentioned the name Royce Gracie. I don't know how many people have seen UFC 1 that are UFC fans today. But everybody will know the name of Royce Gracie, just like they'll know the name Ken Shamrock.
I just don't know what you do with him in wrestling right now.
GM.
Sure.
The interim GM supervisor.
Yeah. And he could be fraternizing.
Ooh. Over the phone.
His voicemails would be probably much more scandalous.
More expensive.
They announced the crowd 20,593, a new record in the Molson Center. And they plugged the next pay-per-view, which would be DX-themed. Then they air a video on Owen and Austin, including Austin winning the King of the Ring, breaking his neck. And then they show Austin with a crossbow, where he was auditioning for the role of Daryl in The Walking Dead. And then they showed the SummerSlam spot. You don't watch Walking Dead, do you? So you're not going to get the reference. But he's like the redneck who always has a crossbow. That's who Austin looked like here. So Austin had this big elaborate entrance where the glass was supposed to break to coincide with his theme music, but the glass did not break. And then it was delayed. Half of it broke. And then he had to, like, shoulder half the glass to break it. So,
which looked awesome.
Yeah, it did.
Which ended up looking awesome. And
I hope it was gimmick glass, or else I would have been very hesitant to just go after the shattered glass and break it.
Well, you know, with the music and everything, I guess it didn't look that impressive. But this was a clip that they've used many times later on their highlight videos and whatnot. Just this guy walking through glass.
Good entrance. So Austin comes out, and then Owen comes out with Team Canada and an Owen 316 t-shirt. And this was actually Owen's first match in a couple of weeks because he had suffered a concussion. And we've got Owen Hart against Steve Austin, rematch from SummerSlam for the IC title.
In Austin's first match?
I think he might have done a house show or two in here. So I don't know if this is his first match back, but certainly first televised match back. And Neidhart runs in, gets stunned as Owen attacks him. Fans are chanting, "Break his neck." And Hart teases the pile driver, but Austin back body drops him. Hart tries to walk out. Austin brings him back. They fight by ringside. Hart chokes him with a cable. And then they tease the spot with the tilt-a-whirl, but Austin lands on his feet, stuns Owen 4 minutes and 3 seconds, which gives a good indication of I think both were not in perfect health here.
Yes.
And then Austin wins the title, very short match, and then stuns LaFon and Furnas afterwards.
Yeah, really not much of a match. It's really only interesting because of the fan reactions and because both men really received equal reaction. Here you had Owen, obviously beloved by this crowd, but also Steve Austin, who was really taken off as a character at the time.
So, two Harts losing titles on this show.
Right, yes.
And then we got a WWF Attitude commercial about being real athletes. And this is a brand new commercial featuring Bret Hart all over it, which I guess would have to have been recut afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately.
Ross then previews the next match, saying it is going to be stiff.
Ooh.
Uh-oh.
Wow.
And then they go to a video for the match. Shawn Michaels, I really love these entrances they did where they came out from their backstage locker rooms.
Yeah, like
and,
the Goldberg entrance.
Yeah, but there was like no music.
No
it was just
commentary.
They had that dun 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 sound that they would put on it.
It was really good and
it looked great.
And really appropriate for the buildup of this match, getting to see behind the scenes as these guys came out.
Yep. And they even have a point where Michaels points to the camera and says, "The red light's on. This might make it onto the show."
Mm. In hindsight, when you watch this match, it's really interesting to look at somebody like Shawn and his performance on this night, knowing what we know now, that this man was about to go out there to participate in screwing this man, I suppose the term is, and basically lying to him for the next few years.
So Michaels comes out, and his entrance, he was like the greatest heel in the world. This crowd, this was such real hatred they had for this man who came out. He picked his nose with the Canadian flag. He humped the flag, wiped his nose with it. And then Bret comes out. I just thought the entrances they did were great. This match felt like such a big deal. It had so much electricity to it, where you had like this realism attached to it. All of the stuff about, if you were a behind the scenes fan following some of this stuff, this had to have been the coolest match to watch live.
Absolutely.
And this arena was just buzzing. Buzzing for this match.
And this was a hostile crowd. I mean, we talk about that whole CM Punk incident from a few weeks back now. And this, like, Shawn is walking down the ramp here, gets pelted by a drink. And to Shawn's credit, doesn't bat an eye. He walks through this like it's mist, in like a light drizzle in the rain.
So Michaels attacks at the bell, and they go to the floor without the bell ringing. Crowd was hot, and I thought Jim Ross just set this scene so great. As much as this match is all remembered for the finish, this is one of the best matches I've ever heard Jim Ross call. I thought Jim Ross was so good here. And this was like probably, this was one of his first pay-per-view main events he got to call in the WWF. Like, he started, like, his first show was back at WrestleMania 9 where he called it, but then it was pretty much always Vince after that. Mm-hmm. And here was Ross getting to call this match. I just thought Ross was so good in this match and made it feel even more important. Ferret sends him into the crowd as Vince and Sergeant Slaughter and some of the agents are out to oversee it, just adding this whole different feel, unlike any kind of WWF match at this time.
Yes.
Ross kind of implies the WCW story, saying everyone knows about this story, but doesn't actually say what it is, but says that there is speculation if Brett loses, this will be his last match.
Yeah, that's really all that he brings up regarding those rumors. It's interesting to watch this match, as I mentioned, because it is such a different match from the WrestleMania 12 match that these two had together, both in the context surrounding it, in the landscape of the pro wrestling industry at the time, and also in the match itself. That was a technical masterpiece. This
was a brawl, and it should have been a brawl. The feud necessitated it.
But this was a brawl. There's a ton of heat there, no doubt. But was there any flow to it whatsoever? No. This was just one hitting each other in one place, followed by hitting each other at the ramp, hitting each other inside the crowd. There was no flow. It was really chaotic and really a mess.
I loved it. I thought it was great. I thought it was everything that you wanted for this feud with these two, where they've come to this boiling point.
Okay, but what did any of it lead to? Like, there's no progression here. There was no one person really getting any advantage at any point. It was just
a bunch of
punches.
It was a fight.
Yeah, to what goal?
Crowd was going nuts for it. They loved it.
Because it was set up very well. Was this a good match, though? I can't say it was.
I thought it was really good. For what it was, this is just a wild brawl. They had Vince yelling at them to get into the ring as they fight at the entrance. They went like a solid like 10 minutes fighting around the arena before they even got to the ring. At one point, Bret Hart punches Jack Doan. They finally get into the ring. As Michaels is selling, they ring the bell. Hart is choking him with a Quebec flag as the crowd is roaring on here. And Michaels then comes back with a flying forearm and attack and chokes Bret with the flag. And they go onto the floor, and Michaels like basically waves off some fan and then spits in the fan's direction. This was rather foul.
Not the only time you would spit.
No, it wouldn't be. Brett's on the floor and gets lifted, drops him chest first onto the step, attacks Brett with the Canadian flagpole, and then wears down Brett with a front chancery. Hart rolls over on a cross body to get a two count. Crowd was just into everything Brett did here. Wrapped the knee of Michaels around the ring post and then applied the figure four. Continues to work on the left knee in the ring. Applies a figure four, which Michaels reversed, and then they broke that. Then Hart jumps off the top rope as Michaels pulls Earl Hebner in front for the most famous ref bump in wrestling history. And Lawler asks, is that a DQ? No, it was not a DQ. And Michaels goes for the sharpshooter. Hebner gets to his feet, calls for the bell, and that is the finish. The infamous Montreal screwjob, with Bret Hart getting up, spitting in Vince's face as Lawler and Ross are just completely confused here as to what happened. Michaels is pissed, leaves with the title alongside Hunter and Jerry Briscoe, and then just raises his arms as he goes to the back, and they quickly go off the air in just a chaotic, chaotic scene.
It's interesting to just replay this moment back over and over and study each individual's reaction to that moment. Because here you can see Shawn Michaels, who for years claimed he knew nothing about this finish. And in Wrestling with Shadows, you can see the scene backstage immediately when he sees Brett swearing to God or whoever he was swearing to that he knew nothing about what was happening. You could just see him in the moments after this bell rang looking shocked And this was acting. This was all acting. This was him.
Which is incredible.
Looking like he was pissed at Vince for screwing him too. He didn't want to be a part of this. And years later, he would come clean. He knew it all along. Hunter as well, who for years claimed he, well, like right afterwards backstage in the scene in Wrestling with Shadows as well, claiming that he didn't know anything about it. In on it this whole time, so...
Where Julie Hart cuts the ultimate promo on Hunter.
What goes around comes around, which really hasn't for Hunter yet.
Oh, yeah, it's really funny. Yeah, you smile.
You know, then Sean just, you know, storms out of the arena pissed off at Vince, grabs the title, and then raises his arms as he leaves the crowd.
This was... just incredible to go back and watch. This was like right out of a movie. Like what they did here, first of all, you have this chaotic scene in the back where Owen and Bulldog are in the gorilla position getting ready to do their run-in, because the spot as it was supposed to go through was that Pat Patterson came up with the sharpshooter idea where Brett reverses it and then gets out, and basically they were going to do a near fall after Sean would hit the sweet chin music then, and then Owen and Bulldog would run in for the DQ before Brett is pinned. And that's how the match was going to end. It was going to be a shitty finish. Mm-hmm. Like, it was going to be a bad finish in terms of the crowd just leaving upset that you don't get a clear-cut winner. But nonetheless, so they're set up there in the back. Earl Hebner does this, is raced to the back where there is a car that is already turned on that takes Earl to the hotel and gets him to an airport.
And
this is crazy.
And Hebner didn't try to make this look smooth. They didn't try to hide this whatsoever. He called for the bell. Before he was even calling for the bell, he was already on his bicycle, just jetting out of there. To the point where, come on, anybody watching this knew something was up. They were not trying to hide anything. He was like... He was really obviously kind of scared. Not maybe just as Brett, but this crowd too, because it was an older crowd, a very smart crowd, and one that that didn't seem too friendly by the end of this show. It's also interesting for me to watch and or to listen to the call of the announcers in this, to hear Jim Ross's reaction to everything that was going on, and Jim Ross's reaction really was just, this happened. There's just silence in the commentary booth, and then Jim Ross's first words, "What happened?" So often, it's an announcer's job to protect any screw up or anything that you can't really explain that the workers do, or to try to make sense of things that you can't really explain on TV. But even Jim Ross here had no explanation. He was just silence, and then he had to admit, fuck, I don't know what's going on. What's going on here? What happened?
It's amazing that, and Lance Storm said this in our documentary, that if you actually look at how this ended, this was a great finish. Like, this should have been the finish they booked, when you think about it. Everyone was protected. Everyone benefited from this. In fact, if you were to have watched this, it should have been Brett completely benefited from this, and there would have been all this backlash towards Vince McMahon and all this. Instead, WCW did nothing with Brett, who came in as the hottest thing in wrestling, the most sympathetic babyface that everyone knew this was real, what happened to this guy. And instead, it was Vince became a billionaire out of this.
He became a star. This was a star-making performance for Vince McMahon.
And it's like this... this was actually, as funny as this is, one of the things was earlier in the week, they even threw the idea by Brett of doing a screw job finish.
Really?
Which was turned down.
Hmm.
So it was a very difficult time period where...
But we could say that, John. There's no way if this was planned and they tried to execute this...
it couldn't have been done this well. No way. You're right. Absolutely. And we've seen that with every single promotion trying to redo this a million times. And unfortunately, that's the worst byproduct of this event, is that everyone felt the need to somehow copy this. And it was just horrendous. Mm-hmm. So there you go. Survivor Series 1997, Way.
Everybody's going to have, you know, their opinions of who was in the right, who was in the wrong. That debate's been done to death. Nobody's opinions are really going to change by this point. It's just, it's nice to look back on a show like this and just, you know, relive the most historical moment in modern pro wrestling history.
Now, we can't judge this based on the repercussions of this. As a standalone 3-hour pay-per-view, what do you give this?
I wasn't very entertained by much of the undercard. I mean, historically, the main event is just incredibly exciting to watch, and the build was very good. As far as a technical match goes, I wouldn't say it was very good. But historically, and the crowd really made it. Everything else was very forgettable, including that Austin return match. So, I give this maybe, I have to give it a 6 simply for the historical significance of the main event.
Wow. I love the main event. I thought it was great, even without all the craziness at the end. But I only give this show a 4 out of 10. This undercard was terrible. Some really bad stuff underneath. Kane Mankind, decent for what it was, considering it's Kane in there. And, no, it's some okay stuff with the Team Canada US match, but nothing great except for the main event. I love that main event. I thought it was great. So now we go to your feedback, and we start off with Corey Ferreira, who writes, easily the most famous match of all time. This show is not even noteworthy besides the main event. It's just really, it's a really awful show, showing how bad a lot of the WWF roster was in late 97. But all that needs to be said about this show is the Bret Shawn match and all the shit that had gone down throughout the week leading into this match, with all the finish changes and ideas on how to end the match. Knowing what we now know about Bret still having a month on his deal and the idea for him to lose the belt the following month in a multi-man match, it would be interesting if that was the idea they went with and how it changes history. Would we ever get a Vince McMahon character to go against Steve Austin? Does Bischoff announce Hart showing up on Nitro as the champion? Does WWF become the powerhouse that they did, or do they go out of business? If anyone can get it, I recommend the Observer issue from a week or two after the show with the great timeline Dave wrote from Bret resigning from the WWF, re-signing in late 96 until 97. Also, will we ever get a review of Wrestling with Shadows to tie in with the last two reviews focused on Montreal?
I don't think so. I've seen that documentary so many times.
I don't know what more is to be said about this thing. Like, even reviewing this.
Yeah, what can we add to it? I don't think so. You guys don't really need to hear what we have to say anyway. Come on. Alan Laycock. This is obviously one of the most pivotal moments in wrestling history. Not the first time a promoter ever screwed a worker, but certainly the most famous. At the time, I remember watching this pay-per-view at my girlfriend's house, and when Bret seemingly tapped out so quickly to his own finisher, I thought it made absolutely no sense. I was more confused than anything else, because if anyone could have broken out of that hold, you would have assumed that it would be Bret. It wasn't until the days and weeks after when I became more upset. Most people I knew at the time were WWE homers, so they took Vince McMahon's side of the argument and said that Bret should have just done what the boss told him to do. But it was never as simple as that. And through Wrestling with Shadows and more other recent interviews, I'm glad that the truth has now finally come out. Bret wasn't just being a selfish jerk. He was reacting to Shawn Michaels telling him that he had no respect for him / his body / the business. And to Vince McMahon... pushing him out of the company. And as a matter of fact, Bret Hart had been completely reasonable, suggesting that he could drop the title that night to someone else, like Stone Cold Steve Austin, or else the match could end in a big brawl, which was the outcome Bret himself thought would be the finish that night. Bret never said he had to beat Shawn, which was one of the myths put out there originally by the pro WWE supporters. Another one was that Bret was done with the company the following night in Ottawa, when he actually still had a month left on his contract, where he could have dropped the title to anyone else over the course of the next 4 weeks. And as an honest man, you know he would have, happily. It didn't need to end like how it did that night in Montreal.
All right, we go on over to Christian Small. I'm going to keep this short, as I think Wei doesn't like reading these that much. He always seems to get annoyed. When this show happened, I was just a few months into watching wrestling, and I wouldn't understand the importance of the main event until later on. This was really a one-match show, and that match influenced the business so much. WWE would not let it drop until the Shawn Bret DVD came out. Bret's only real use in WCW came when they kept referring to this incident, and it seems that nearly every company out there has copied this finish for an angle in one way or another. When it comes to the actual show, I was surprised that Austin Owen was so short, and after listening to Colt's podcast last week, I missed the nation's rap entrance. For such a hot time in wrestling, a lot is easily forgotten.
Andrew McDonald, I was digging through my old WWF tapes to see if I had this one, but sadly this wasn't around. There was the best of the Survivor Series tape that I had, which is from 1987 to 97, but it's just not the same. so I'll try to recite it from memory. I did like the Survivor Series matches being the majority of the card, and it was one of my favorite pay-per-views of the year when it took place. They had a lot on this card, though I don't remember any of them standing out technically. It was still a great novelty at the time. The biggest standouts in those matches were the New Age Outlaws, who were still doing their deal when they had no entrance music, but just had Road Dogg go on the mic talking during the entrance. I felt that it was pretty innovative at the time. Eventually, they got their iconic entrance and thankfully kept Road Dogg talking. I also remember the Owen 316 shirt. Maybe I could get a random t-shirt company to make me one of those. And lastly, the Montreal Screwjob. My cousin was a huge fan of Bret Hart, and he forever lost interest in professional wrestling after this. He's now married and living on the mainland of Nova Scotia, but sometimes when he's back home, he'll ask what's going on in wrestling, as he knows I'm still a fan. My aunt, as well, was a huge Bret Hart fan, and still has tapes of many episodes of Raw from 1997 in her house, which I could try to grab for a future review of episodes. She also started to lose interest in wrestling after the screw job. It's a shame that WCW didn't strike when the iron was hot with Bret, and as we all know, WCW ruins everything. The match itself, though, was a testament to Shawn and Bret's professionalism. Even though Shawn took part in the screw job, he still went 20 minutes with the man who hated him, and vice versa. For that effort and the significance of the show, an 8 out of 10.
Alexander Rios from Miami, Florida. Survivor Series 97. What else can possibly be said about this show? Is there even anything left to be said? Oh, wait, there is. There was actually an undercard before Bret vs. Shawn, too, and a pretty solid one at that. Kane, Sin Cara mood lighting treatment and all, versus Mankind definitely had its place, with Mick Foley being the perfect guy to put Kane over as the unbeatable monster. And Austin versus Owen in the return match for the IC title? After 3 months, who wasn't cheering for Austin, just to get back in the ring after that horrible neck injury? I won't say much else because I said way too much about Bret vs. Shawn on the Greatest Rivalries review. I will say this, to so many people, this show, or WrestleMania 14, was the official start of the Attitude Era, which I have enjoyed replaying on WWE 13 and taking the WWE factor out of the equation. There was no way the WWF was going out of business, especially guys like Austin getting over huge and WCW being WCW. 9 screw jobs out of 10.
We go to Chris in Ottawa, who says, it's amazing to see The Rock so over as a heel, but also Ken Shamrock so over as a babyface. WWF did a great job building both performers, and it's clear that the guy who had the talent to make it to the very top was able to do that when given the opportunity. And it made me think of how few gambles the WWE takes with brand new talent today, and how sometimes you just need to strap that rocket to a blue chipper's back and see whether you get fire or fizzle. Did anyone else squirm when Hawk described the Nation of Domination as a criminal element and then described their team as the police? Not exactly shades of gray, WWF. I must be crazy because I popped like a balloon when Farouk got tagged in and immediately went to work on Ahmed's delicate kidneys. As methodical as much of the match was, I'm so glad I watched it when Animal hit a shoulder block on Kama, creating an incredible amount of mic feedback. JR's theory that the sound was Kane leaving the arena had me doubled over with laughter, not to mention one of the only Kevin Dunn references in the history of WWE television.
Go to Jay Hunter, who writes, finally, you guys review a most important landmark in wrestling history, Steve Blackman's pay-per-view debut. Survivor Series gang rules. Why would you promote a pay-per-view around that awful faction action bollocks? Actually, have WWE ever done a great job showcasing how and why teams are formed for traditional Survivor Series matches? Just feels like they announced the team members and have one vignette where they're all together to laugh at each other's promos. I loved how the ring announcer spoke in French. It made the show feel much more worldwide instead of constantly catering exclusively for the Yanks. Initially, I was really annoyed to see Vince away from the commentary booth as I loved the three-man setup. As the show progressed, I was worried that someone else had died, as Pillman had last month, as the commentators awkwardly dodged why Vince had more important business backstage. I had no idea. Sure, all of my news came from WWF Magazine. Austin looked out of shape and still injured, same when he wrestled the next month. I guess they couldn't hold off his in-ring debut and his in-ring return any longer. One last thing, please say one of you loved Kane's red light matches. I thought it was awesome that his powers knocked out all of the WWF's lights except for the red one. If he wrestled Sin Cara, they could add the colors and the spotlight would be green.
All right, we go to Dennis, who says, dear John and Way, normally I just sit back and enjoy listening to feedback from the listeners, but in this case I feel I would be remiss if I did not share my experiences on this event. In 1997, I was away at school when Survivor Series was taking place. With the build-up of this perhaps being the last match between Michaels and Hart, I was very interested, but I could not find a venue to see this pay-per-view. The next day, a classmate suggested that I go to the internet to find out what happened. I was shocked to discover so much information about Survivor Series. Theories, conspiracy theories, backstage dramas about the night. I personally feel that the Survivor Series was the one of the main contributions to the increased popularity of wrestling on the internet. It seemed as if the information about the wrestling industry and wrestling sites after the Montreal Screwjob grew exponentially. Also, I feel that a show like Off the Record exploded in popularity with the amount of interviews done with Bret Hart and Vince McMahon. The effect of this one night was everlasting. Keep up the good work, Dennis. And he's right. I think.
Oh, off the record. It had only debuted in September of that year, and Brett was one of their first guests, and from there, they really followed this whole story.
And as well as the internet, you know? The internet, imagine, like, I mean, at 97, I don't know how many people even had internet access to be able to go online to read as much as it has eventually come out, but imagine...
International.
Imagine if there was Twitter around back in 1997 during this whole thing.
Hashtag Montreal. Screw job.
Hashtag Vince just walked out of Brett's locker room. Dazed. Cranky Vince commenting about the...
All the guys touting.
Yeah.
But not showing up at Raw the next night. Mick Foley was one of the guys, along with the Hart Foundation, who skipped Raw the next night over this. Go to Zach Volk. At the time, I had no idea Brett was leaving, and this would be the last time I would see him in the WWF. I remember having a weird feeling like there was something different going on. WWF sort of treated the match oddly, with Ross and Vince dropping in references this would be the last time it would happen, and there was that weird start to the match where Brett and Shawn just brawled. Once I noticed the crowd was reacting to Brett oddly, and there were signs referencing him leaving, I figured out Brett must be on his way out, which at the time was not an unusual thing to happen to people you really cared about in WWF, so that really bummed me out. When the finish happened, I was wondering what the hell WWF would do to cover. It was one of those times where you couldn't wait until Raw the next night, which is something that never happens anymore.
Danny Chestnuts. Nothing about the main event felt right. It was the first time that I felt the line between real life and sports entertainment had been blurred. It was uncomfortable to watch, especially for a then 14-year-old wrestling fan who always trusted that it was all part of the story. This wasn't, and my favorite superstar was the scapegoat. Looking back, I strongly disagree with how Hart was treated, but you can't argue with the long-term outcome featuring the birth of the Mr. McMahon character, even if Vince did stumble into it. It's amazing to think that the biggest heel in WWE history was created by accident. There's no way Vince knew how much heat he would draw. This one event kicked off the greatest era in sports entertainment, and as such, it's hard to give it a failing grade. 7 screw jobs out of 10.
Martin from Montreal. I was 19 years old when I went to this show, and back then the internet wasn't as big as it was today, so there was really no way to know what was going on backstage, but I still remember thinking that something wasn't right after the main event. That this wasn't the actual finish of the match, and like everybody in the arena that night, I was pissed that such a great match ended like this. How far as the rest of the show was concerned, I really was a nothing show, but at less... They kept the original concept of the Survivor Series for must of the card. The Mankind Kane match is really hard to follow, mostly because of the damn red light. And the Owen Austin match wasn't great, but by the end of it, the fans went crazy for Austin, even though they hated him at the beginning. If you take the screw job out of the show, I'd give it a 5 out of 10. But being that the screw job was such a historic event, I have to give it an 8 out of 10. On a side note, I found it funny. The WWE, I don't know. This, anyway.
Anthony from New Jersey. I'm sure all of the feedback is generally the same, so I'll try to add something different. I'm not sure if you guys are aware, but in WWE 13 during the Attitude Era mode, you have to play as Shawn Michaels and put Bret Hart in the sharpshooter, and then Vince calls for the bell. I recently watched the pay-per-view, and while watching the playing the match as Michaels, I noticed that some of the lines on commentary are actual lines either J.R.R. Lawler used while calling the match back in 97. It was a nice added touch, as was the pre-match backstage scene with Triple H, Shawn Michaels, and Vince McMahon, in which Triple H says, F that, if Bret doesn't want to do business, we'll do business for him. And Bret Hart spitting in Vince's face after the match. First game I bought since No Mercy, and so far, I don't regret it.
I really want to play this game.
I do too.
This Attitude Era mode sounds fucking awesome.
Yeah, this sounds...
It sounds pretty crazy that they would put that whole thing. You have to
fuck
put,
Brett.
You got,
if you won't do business, we'll do business for him.
You have to apply the sharpshooter to Brett. I think that's brilliant.
It's great.
I still think the whole thing was a huge work. And if you watch the Legends of Wrestling Roundtable episode where they talk about the rivalry and the screw job, Lawler thinks it was a work as well. Maybe that's just the Memphis in him. Either way, when push comes to shove, this kicked off the most profitable era for the most successful promotion in the history of the wrestling business. 10 Bret Hart loogies out of 10.
Andrew Sheehy writes, 97 will go down as the most memorable year in pro wrestling. This show is proof of it. The show is remembered for one thing, the Montreal Screwjob. Heading into the show, there were so many booking scenarios discussed when the match between Bret and Shawn for the title was announced and came up during production meetings at Raw tapings during the fall of 97. The Attitude Era was in full swing when the show happened as it started earlier that year at WrestleMania 13. The idea of having Bret getting screwed out of the title was a risky but great idea for the company to come up with. It was originally scheduled to end in DQ, but it ended up with this finish. The match is one of the most important in the history of pro wrestling. It was very real to me, as I was 7 years old at the time. It helped establish Mr. McMahon as the character, it helped grow ratings for the WWF, and it helped build to an Austin McMahon feud in 98 and 99. The event is one of the big reasons why Wrestling with Shadows is a must-see for all fans. Great show, 8 out of 10.
From Hanzi. Back then, as I watched it live, I didn't know what had occurred because I was expecting a final resolution to this feud. I remember being so hyped for this event because Stone Cold was returning, and this Bret Shawn feud was surreal because earlier in the year, the word on the internet was that Shawn didn't want to work with Bret in a match or have a physical interaction with him. I think it was a work, but who knows. Anyways, I just remember being down on this event because the matches weren't that great, and the shitty ending, which ended up being the most memorable ending in the company's history. I was wondering what would happen, because that Friday going into the Survivor Series, the internet broke the news about Bret leaving. So I was really bummed, because I somehow knew Bret wasn't going to win. After an underwhelming pay-per-view, I said, at least there's no school tomorrow, because there was already a two-week strike. But as soon as the pay-per-view ended, the local news said the teachers were going back to work on Monday morning.
Aw, shit.
It was so depressing. Back then, when an event was really good or really bad based on results, I wouldn't care about what was being taught in school. I would be focused on what had transpired, so I was depressed thinking that WCW was going to win this war because they now have Bret Hart. Sorry for the long side story. I thought you guys might have found it funny or pathetic, depending on whichever you choose.
All right, and that wraps up all of our feedback on the 97 Survivor Series, one of the most famous matches ever. Depending on your perspective. So you can always leave your feedback at lawradio.proboards.com every single week when we review a new classic event, as well as Raw and Impact every week. And Wei, before we talk about what more is coming up this week, because we got a busy one, what are we going to review next week? Where do you feel like going? I don't care. If you want to do what we originally discussed, what we further discussed, something different, what do you decide?
Okay. Well, there's this documentary I've really wanted to watch for a very long time, and I'm really, really looking forward to watching it. It's called The Backyard.
Oh.
Yeah, it's called The Backyard. It's about pro wrestling. And
this has been requested by, I think, a few people.
Yeah, okay, cool. It's called The Backyard, and it's about pro wrestling.
It's a 2003 documentary. Me and Wei are going to watch it. Next week we'll chat about it right here on Review Away. In the meantime, odds are we're going to miss Impact this week, so we might do a show on Friday, just chatting. We'll see. We'll see how time permits, but I'm going to venture to guess why we're not going to watch Impact on Friday, because Thursday, because I am not going to a bar to watch Impact. I draw the line.
Yeah, and I guess I'm very sorry to any TNA fans out there, because Impact is usually the biggest casualty anytime we have a very busy week, but
I'm not sorry. I'm exhausted right now.
If we're going to cut a show, I mean, yeah. Thursdays, unfortunately, are usually the days that are too busy for us.
So maybe we'll have a podcast on Friday. But anyway, if you are focusing on UFC 154 and a fight fan, we have tons of coverage this week on Fight Network. We're here in Montreal all week for the fights and then Saturday night at the show. Me and Wei just finished doing 11 interviews today for Fight Network, including Filthy Tom Lawler with his thoughts on the fake heart attack angle involving Paul Heyman and CM Punk.
Tom Lawler, a huge pro wrestling fan.
Even watches NXT. That's how big of a fan he is.
Big fan. So that is one of the 11 interviews we have that will also be up at youtube.com/fightnetwork. All week long, we are also touting tout.com/lawradio, and you can follow us at way0937, at I am John Pollock. Find out what we're doing, find out what we're eating, and find out what Tim Hortons we are at. Mm-hmm. So you can just live vicariously through us. And we're going to go out here with...
Play the song. Play the song.
Just met a boy, just met a boy when he could come inside of my playpen. Because he looks like a superstar in the making. So I think that I'm going in for the taking. And through the grapevine that he... We could shoot a movie, he could do the taping. Boom, 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 pow, this thing be shaking. I ain't even trying to find out who he dating. Because I know... Just met a boy when he could become my little problem. Cause he looked like he modeled in clothes in Dublin. So I think that he getting that green a goblin. Here through the grapevine that he hangs. We could shoot a movie cup like Rambo. Boom, boom, pow, this thing's so bingo. Wondering if he could understand my lingo. Cause I know he got a wife at home. But I need just a night alone. If he I'm